Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Parag Khanna, who is a senior fellow at the New American Foundation in Washington, D.C., and director of its Global Governance Initiative. He's the author of a new book, The Second World, Empires and Influence in the New Global Order. Parag, welcome to Berkeley.
Thank you so much, Harry.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in India in the 70s, late 70s, to date myself, and grew up in Abu Dhabi, Dubai, and then came to the U.S. when I was about seven, and have been a New Yorker, more or less, ever since, except for a stint in Germany during high school. And so I've bounced around quite a lot.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
We traveled.
That was the most important
yeah. thing, because that bug sort of bit me very early and has never left me ever since.
And were your parents diplomats or journalists?
No, my father at the time was working for Tata Exports, which remains one of India's largest conglomerates. And at the time, he was representing them in Middle Eastern exports. And so my parents, even before I was born, had lived in Sudan and Cairo and in the Gulf.
Mm-hmm. So you at the dinner table, in addition to all this moving, you really had a global perspective. Did you talk about politics a lot, international affairs?
Well, it was just important that before coming to America, I had a consciousness of life outside of America that stuck with me always. And so even when I was growing up in suburban New York, I was always paying attention to what was happening out there. And I was different. I brought politics to the dinner table in a family that was much involved in business and science, and I'm more or less the first to do that. But as you may have noticed, the book is dedicated to my grandfather, who was an Indian civil servant and diplomat who worked some time in East Africa. So there was it's in the family, but in the nuclear family, I'm the only one who remained so into it.
And so where were you educated? I mean, in all of these places, and then where did you do your undergraduate work?
It was an obvious choice for me to go to Georgetown, to the School of Foreign Service. I was living in Germany, finishing high school there and earning an Abitur, and I just knew that this was my career. So I went to Georgetown, and I did another year in Berlin, actually, during that time. And afterwards, I worked at the Council on Foreign Relations, the World Economic Forum in Switzerland. But I came back to Brookings in D.C., and at that point, I started working on my master's and Ph.D. At Georgetown.
And what about languages along the way? You must have picked
one
up a lot.
One picks them up.
Yes.
One also forgets them at times, depending. But my German and English are basically the same. Hindi is my native language, but is rusty, doesn't get used as much. But these days I spend a lot of time going to India and Pakistan, so I get to use it a bit more. And French and Spanish I've picked up along the way. I've been trying to teach myself Arabic, and it was of some use for the months that I spent traveling through the Middle East, obviously. But one needs to really focus a lot more on that, which is actually something I plan to do.
Mm-hmm. And what do you consider yourself to be, an analyst in the traditional academic sense, international relations, plus a journalist, or how do you pigeonhole yourself?
In academic terms, I would have to be a political scientist and an international relations theorist. That's certainly my training. But in professional terms, just analyst is fine with me in terms of observing, integrating trends in world affairs and forging certain lessons out of that for either our policy community or for others, or for myself. So analyst works, but journalist never. Interestingly enough, and when you're traveling around the world, you don't want people to think you're a journalist because they're going to feed you certain messages. And so unlike an interview as a journalist would conduct it, I never felt that I interviewed anyone of the thousands of people who I talked to for this book. It always felt like a conversation, a debate, an argument, or a social get-together, or just an information gathering, but never a formal interview as such.
So if a student out there wanted to do what you do, what are the skills required? You clearly have to be a listener.
That's for sure, but I would say that one should really, to make an impact and a dent and really get what you want out of a journey, You have to be very well prepared. I use the think tank base that I've sort of been professionally active in for some years to get all of the knowledge, information, and theories and attitudes sort of, you know, down. And there was a lot of book work before I ever left the country to go on one of these multi-month kind of voyages to different continents. So you really have to be prepared in the traditional sense of doing all your homework, talking to all the right people, meeting, you know, foreign dignitaries and experts and so forth, and then you go, which then requires a different set of skills, which mm-hmm. are the traveler's skills, listening, integrating, meeting people, connecting on multiple levels, making connections, but also this sort of one-on-one kind of connection.
Mm-hmm. And is that, in the second part of the agenda, is that really talking to cab drivers, talking to restaurant owners, people in the cafe? Yeah. I mean, how do you do that?
Right.
And I guess you have to have a facility for finding yourself at home everywhere.
That fortunately, I guess I've always had. But there is a certain method to the madness. It is certainly a matter of, again, leveraging the connections that one has from Washington and setting up certain meetings with key people. So I was able to meet ambassadors, prime ministers, officials, and executives and whatnot everywhere just by that. But that was only the tip of the iceberg. And what you do is you leave enough time in any given country to see what happens, basically, because every other person who you interview or speak with says, oh, you need to meet my brother, you need to meet my friend, they do this, 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 and this. And then you stay and you explore, and you want us to be judicious about who to talk to and about what. But you have to let it unfold. So a lot of people have asked, you know, who did you talk to? And the answer is everyone. It isn't just taxi drivers or waiters and waitresses and students and journalists and officials. It's literally everyone until I got the picture.
And when do you know that you have a feel for the place? Talk about that creative process where you've done all this prepping, you've done meetings in Washington, and then you come to the place. When does the aha, I get this place come?
Yeah, and the rule was never to leave the country. And because I came into a region on a one-way ticket and stayed for months and traveled through the countries overland and then flew out, I had the luxury of not having to leave a place till I was sure that I was done. Mm-hmm. And when does that sort of, you know, light bulb go off? Strictly speaking, it's sort of, you know, when does the marginal value of each conversation, mm-hmm. you know, diminish to zero? And that occurs in some countries after a week. In other places, it takes well over a month. But there was also no rule for that. But I did go in with a long set of questions for every country and everyone who I met. And when I felt I had the answer that I was going to eventually write in the book, that's when I felt confident enough to just move on.
How long did it take you to write this book?
2 years.
2 years. And what is it you wanted to prove or find out?
It's interesting. Before I started, there was I was motivated by two totally distinct things. One was watching Lonely Planet television, the TV show, in which the treatment of fascinating exotic countries is totally superficial. But I was well aware that there's obviously a great deal of social, political complexity to be explored in these places. And I actually wanted to do a TV show that would have been deeper and more granular and more sort of constructive and politically useful educationally. But it didn't work out as a TV show. The other motivation was, as again, a political scientist saying, why is everyone saying China is going to run the 21st century, but then there's the literature saying America will remain a hegemon for another century, mm-hmm. and then there's the literature saying Europe sets the new global standard for transnational governance. And I wanted to blend it all into one book because these were three distinct literatures, but we live on one planet. So I wanted to kind of accomplish mm-hmm. both at the same time. The thesis wound up being obviously more sketched out formally before I left. And fortunately, I suppose, all the travel and the research wound up sort of bearing that out. But I had relatively solid notions of wanting to discuss not just the decline of American power, which anyone can do, but to, in a neutral, unbiased way, synthesize the observations and literature on China and Europe at the same time.
So it was you had a sense of the trends that everybody's talking about. Interestingly enough, those trends, when you're talking about international politics, often are not talked about in the context of what's happening in particular countries that might be influential. Right. Here, we're not talking about China, Europe, and the United States, but rather what you have called the second world.
And this is where the Lonely Planet comes in, because I basically said I could just sit and read white papers at Brookings on from our government, from Europe, and from China, but that's not going to answer the question. I aim to spend as little time in those global capitals as possible and spend all my time in the so-called second world, where I believe the answer lies.
And so tell us what the second world is, because it's a big category with a lot of different states in it from the different regions of the world.
Right. It's hard to obviously paint one coherent sort of or wrap it all in one theory, though I actually have tried to do that. But effectively, there's two criteria or two dimensions. One is that these are the most strategic countries geographically with the most resources and potential in terms of where geopolitical alliances may shift and the significance that each shift may have for other countries. So these are critical and strategic in that area. That, in that sense, analytically, I fall into line with Paul Kennedy's work on pivotal states and so forth. But again, telling the story as a narrative from the inside out. The second issue, though, is a socioeconomic one. I mean, one of the major trends that people talk about has nothing to do with great power rivalry and so forth. It's globalization and inequality. And to what extent is globalization making societies wealthier or creating divisions within them? Hence the title Second World. I no longer use it to apply to socialist countries the way it was back then, but I figured we still use the term First World and Third World. These are countries that are both at the same time. And that's the new reality across the planet.
Give us some more descriptive elements here about these second world countries, because I know one of the things that you're saying, I believe, is these people, these states are being changed and the peoples in them by globalization. But in the context of that, they want to make their own decision
exactly
about what they're going to be.
Right. I kept hearing in every country, and of course, totally unconnected from each other, people saying, we're going to do it our way. Mm-hmm. Now that the Cold War is over and we are empowered by globalization and we see this, what I call a geopolitical marketplace, we can do something with the Chinese, with the Europeans, mm-hmm. and with America, but not exclusively with anyone. So the Brazilians say, there's going to be a Brazilian way. And the Indians say there's an Indian way, and the Kazakhs say there's a Kazakh way. I think Kazakh way is literally their doctrine, So I kept hearing this and feeling it everywhere, and the rising confidence of diplomats, of business people in all these countries to say, we'll do business with all sides. And, there's a lot of, it's certainly in the language that they use. It's sort of, I have a meeting here with an American diplomat, but I'm rushing to meet a Chinese energy executive, that kind of thing. And in fact, in Saudi Arabia and in a number of countries that we've considered strong American allies, and Saudi Arabia in particular, there's now a fair balance in the diversity of investment coming into the country from America, Europe, and China or Asian countries. And that is the underlying data which one can use to demonstrate this point. But, take countries like Libya, where the same thing is also happening. So I felt this and saw it and heard it and talked about it with people just about everywhere. And it became a real common denominator for the book.
And this is very different from what Waltz called the bipolar world of the Cold War, where you were on one side or the other and mm-hmm. a few countries might switch. These states and their leaders and the people they represent really are ready to play the game on different issues and with regard to different resources that they might have.
Absolutely. The picture could not be more complex and fuzzy than this sort of static notion of bipolarity or even just straight multipolarity in the 19th century European sense. The way I describe it in the book, countries aren't just aligning one side or the other. You're with us or you're with the other guy. Nor is it non-alignment, the sort of Cold War, Third World bloc. What I call it is multi-alignment, as I just described it. It's countries saying, we'll take all the investment and aid from Europe, which leads the world in those categories, but we'll also start to have stronger relations in terms of exports and imports and even military relationship with China. And then there's the traditional sort of political allegiance and assistance and whatnot that comes from the United States. But playing all sides is a perfectly valid strategy in the 21st mm-hmm. century, and second world countries are doing it better than anyone.
Mm-hmm. And in looking at these places as diverse as Venezuela, Libya, you look at Kazakhstan, Turkey, what positions them to be most influential in the world? Because part of what you're arguing is the changes occurring because of globalization empower this category of states to shape the future.
One of the most interesting things that I did not plan on sort of observing or was not part of my original thesis was the connections between or among second world countries themselves. And that's happening at two levels. One is the regional, where Brazil, Argentina, Chile, and others are saying, Mercosur was a really small sort of trade unit. We want to build a South American community of nations and bring us all into the second world or into the first world. Obviously, the latter would take a long time. But you find it in the Arab world, where Arab countries are saying, it's not just about the oil-rich countries having the chance to elevate into the first world, but let's start spending oil wealth in the oil-deprived countries like Egypt, Morocco, and so on, and work on developing them. So this regional second-world integration is something that's a very important dynamic, and regionalism became ultimately the structure for the book. But the second level is totally transnational, and I call it the anti-imperial belt. It was the best term I could come up with for it, but it really is mixing this notion of we'll play all sides, so we are anti the imperial hegemony of any one superpower, but also globalization allows us to connect with each other. So when you see Ahmadinejad go to Venezuela, or you see a Belarus, Kazakhstan, Malaysia meeting or summit, that is what is going on. That is what this is actually about. It's globalization letting people connect with each other across areas, technology, energy, counterterrorism, security, trade. It's happening everywhere. One can no longer, it boggles the mind to try to capture the permutations and combinations of diplomatic relationships that are being led by the second world rather than following Moscow or Washington. And that's a lot of what I get into in that.
And isn't it also the case you're suggesting that these connections and interconnections aren't necessarily happening in international forum where we expect to see them in the UN or other kinds of, but rather sometimes organizations that they're creating themselves.
Absolutely. So it's the regional organizations that I alluded to earlier. In the East Asian area, for example, used to be APEC, or at least America used to believe that APEC calls the shots. Now it's ASEAN, ASEAN plus three, the ASEAN Regional Forum, the East Asian Community or East Asian Summit, indigenously building diplomatic institutions which aren't explicitly intended to rival the United Nations as such, though an Asian Monetary Fund is certainly meant to exclude the International Monetary Fund. But it has to do with basically globalization resisting centralization. You can no longer centralize power, even normative power, in the United Nations. And so it isn't just the Bush administration that has weakened the United Nations, it's globalization and these trends.
And what when you think of globalization, among the things you think about is media, basically. To what was your sense from your trips of the extent to which the individuals in these countries are watching the world and are better informed about the possibilities for themselves and for their country?
It plays a tremendous role. And let's focus, for example, just on the Arab world, where Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya have played a massive role in basically creating what I call the new Arabism. It's not the political Arabism of the past. It's cultural. It's economic. I mentioned the investment across and the labor movement across poor and rich Arab countries. And it's this melting pot that's been created in the city of Dubai, which is really the new capital of Arab civilization and is a global city in its own right. The extent to which when you go into Al Arabiya, you find people from Morocco, from Syria, from Lebanon, from the Gulf, everywhere coming together. So the whole next generation of Arabs not only is aware that there are other Arab countries and peoples, but are actually blending together better. And of course, for centuries, they have had language and religion in common. So the potential for this next generational regional Arab melting pot driven by media is quite powerful.
What is the reaction to these old atavistic issues that have never been solved? One thinks of the Palestine Israel conflict. You know, one thinks of the problems that go back to the Cold War that were never resolved. I mean, are people beyond that or what?
No, I mean, if they were, then we wouldn't have the conflict. Yeah. But let's talk about the remedies. Look at Israel-Palestine, Kashmir between India and Pakistan, and Taiwan-China. Take three of these major sort of, you know, hot spots in the world. The some of the most commonly prescribed or discussed solutions in all three of them basically say globalize it, integrate, erase the border, don't eliminate the state, but do away with the resistance and the walls, mm-hmm. and allow these societies to economically integrate, and sort of, you know, economic growth and so forth could bring a certain political harmonization. It's certainly foremost on the agenda between India and Pakistan to have that be the best approach to resolving Kashmir after, you know, almost 60 years. Taiwan and China are already well on their way to doing that, in fact. So there is a new approach that has come with the rise of globalization to conflict resolution, some of these core, the thorniest conflicts that we've had of the last half century.
In international relations theory, in an earlier phase, globalization, I think, was called interdependence, and it had not reached the strength that it now has. So obviously globalization is a qualitatively different phenomena. But the notion always was, by those who watched interdependence and watched globalization, that it would transform the world and wipe away the old geopolitical struggles of state power. That's not the position you take. So
no,
let's talk about how you see the global structure of power within which the second world that we've just talked about is interfacing.
Well, I'm concerned with the argument that globalization eliminates geopolitics, because we have had globalization before, and what I point out is that globalization is an imperial enterprise. The wave of globalization that we've seen, that we saw from the 1970s onwards, was an American Western-driven globalization. Now we are seeing a European type of globalization that is exporting itself and its model, and of course a Chinese-led globalization. So the notion that there is one globalization that leads to one interdependence and serves everyone equally is very, very badly mistaken. And that's the tension that I talk about between globalization and geopolitics that actually frames the book. Rather than view them as competitive forces, I view them as two sides of the same coin. And that's where the geopolitics of today has not stopped. You know, history has not stopped, but it functions within a globalization framework, which is unique in human history.
So talk about the three poles, basically, because what you're really saying is we have a world which is not unlike a stool with three legs,
right.
and that we have to understand the elements of the structure. Talk a little about that. What can you tell us about China, the U.S., and Europe that are common in this particular context as they relate to the Second World, which we've just described?
Right. I mean, there's most certainly, the train has left the station on European integration and creating a European model of governance and of diplomacy. The same goes for China, and then there's us. These are not irreconcilable, but they are certainly unique, and the clock cannot be turned back on their rise. It is, again, it's no more preventable than globalization itself. But what matters in terms of the Second World is the common agenda and problems that we all face diplomatically. Again, in a globalized world, in an interdependent world, we talk about transnational problems. We talk about poverty, climate, post-conflict reconstruction, counterterrorism. These are areas where Europe, China, and America have very, very clear common interests in terms of, you know, promoting prosperity and the growth of markets and preventing violent terrorism and so forth. But yet we don't find in our diplomacy among the big three, as I call them, the common agenda and the division of labor that we need to have sort of what I call an equilibrium in the 21st century. But the Second World countries is where a lot of this is playing out. That's where you have the most economic growth, where you have a lot of greenhouse gas emissions. You have instability in regions because of conflicts or post-conflict situations. And you have border zones of immense poverty. All of these things are happening in the second and the sort of third worlds, but we don't have a common geopolitical strategy towards addressing them.
Now, in the relations between these three poles, is are we done with war, to exaggerate here, or not?
It's amazing. There are friends of mine who I thought were realists who say to me, you know, your book is fine, but I really don't take seriously the notion of major power war anymore. We're just too interdependent. Mm. obviously, you know, we heard of something like that about a century ago. I worry a great deal because we have three totally unlike systems. In European history, we at least had a common culture and so forth, and even a common geography. Today, we have a non-Western system, which is China, and we have something that isn't even a country, which is the European Union, and then we have the United States. The possibilities for misunderstanding, miscommunication, and sort of, you know, a flawed diplomacy are absolutely immense. So I worry about it from that point of view. I also worry about it because even minus direct confrontation, which obviously never happened in the Cold War, the second world, the proxy states, the allies that are multi-aligning and being pulled in multiple directions, historically those are the countries who skirmishes with each other and the multiple backers that they have. That is what causes war. And there's more of that going on than ever before. So most certainly one has to worry about situations like Iran and, of course, Iran-Iraq. One has to worry about Central Asia and its energy resources and to what extent oil supplies, if stretched thin and going in multiple directions, could lead to sort of a face-off, you know, between Western and Eastern powers and so on. So there's many opportunities still for conflict to take place. And one other thing to add is that most certainly, the U.S., EU, and China are increasingly economically integrated and interdependent in terms of their trade and mutual investment. But they are also building these zones, the EU zone, the East Asian zone, and the NAFTA sort of zone, which are becoming trade blocks in their own right and still have greater trade or increasingly have greater trade within each other than they have with each other. So one has to worry about the political calculus 10, 15, 20 years from now when it does become feasible to strike militarily or politically or otherwise financially as well at others and face less of a consequence than we think we would face today. And those are the things that people who look long-term at geopolitics and conflict should be worried about.
And you and I want to emphasize this point because what you're saying is that each one of these poles is really heavily into a region, which is not to say that they won't go into the other fellow's region to poach, make deals, or get resources.
And that is, again, we talk about a globalized and interdependent world, but what we're talking about right now is the classic stuff of geopolitics, which is building pan-regions in one's own hemisphere to attain a certain self-sufficiency while sniping and poaching, as you say, in other regions to either destabilize others or get what one wants. So the U.S. and China going after energy and minerals in Africa underneath Europe's nose, which provides the most aid and investment and political support to Africa, is but one example of this. China moving into Latin America, where America felt that, you know, the Monroe Doctrine has been the sort of dominant paradigm for 200 years, is another example of this. And this will happen. And the U.S. attempting to build an India-Japan Australia triangle and expanded NATO to contain China is a third example of this. So pan-regions are developing in terms of trade and trade blocks, yes, but this crisscrossing, globalized, undermining each other is also happening, and both can take place at the same time.
Now looking again at how the Second World interfaces with this, they have, many of them, not all of them, have resources, which everybody is interested, especially the U.S., Europe, and China, because of their needs. But on the other hand, as we said before, they want to protect their identity. Basically, they want to do it their way in this very diverse world.
Right, and each Second World country has to manage the geopolitical suitors, as I call them, Europe, the U.S., and China. It has to manage globalization. It has to manage its own governance and domestic challenges. Often that means overpopulation, economic strain, teetering markets and the like, rising food prices and so forth, and unstable governance when it comes to transitions from authoritarian regimes to democracy. All of these things are happening in many Second World countries at the same time. And when you throw in oil into some of them, those that are oil rich, you really have, you know, a potentially combustible mix. And one of the lessons I came away with is that no matter how much time, I said earlier, I never left a country till I felt like I had the story. There's one fundamental thing that I never got, which is, in 5 years, will country X be stable? Will it have made it to the first world, or will it have collapsed? Or 10 years? That I cannot answer about a single country that I was in. And I think it would be foolish to make that prediction because so much could go right. Each Second World country has enormous potential, and I focus on that. And they have enormous liabilities, and I focus on that. And you just don't know which will win.
You're suggesting that because of the style of these three different poles, we can say a lot about how they're succeeding on this battlefield or playing field of globalization in this part of the world that you call the Second World. So let's talk about Europe and how it approaches both its own region and the rest of the world. What is distinctive about its style, the way it's doing it, the way it's competing?
Right. It's really a two-part kind of strategy. There is a very pronounced and effective European strategy towards integrating countries on its own periphery. Europe has expanded, the European Union has expanded by one country per year on average, since the collapse of the Soviet Union. Once a country is in the EU, it stays in the EU. It really locks them in on every conceivable level. I call it lobotomy. It basically really guts their regulatory, legal frameworks. Everything becomes European, the currency eventually as well. That has worked and is spreading into the Balkans as well, and maybe as far as Ukraine, maybe to Turkey and the Caucasus. But the more or less the maximal geographic extent of the European Union's core membership in the next 10 to 15 years reaches to Ukraine. The Baltics are already in, all the way to the Caspian Sea and the Balkans. But what about beyond that? That's where Europe is actually fumbling to create a whole new kind of strategy or neighborhood policy. It needs to have a strong global strategy with China, which is actually quite good, other than intellectual property issues, a strong strategy towards India, and then a strong strategy towards the Gulf, where it's working on maybe some, or the Middle East. There's some peacekeeping missions, such as Lebanon, a free trade area with the Gulf Cooperation Council, and then North Africa, which is its immediate non-Western sort of Arab periphery, where it's doing very interesting things that are totally underappreciated in terms of investment in those economies in a non-colonial sort of way, of course, but drawing the energy resources that it needs, but serving as a huge market. And then obviously the integration by immigration that many people consider a great threat to Europe, by way of the economic interdependence that's happening, could hopefully create actually a zone of stability, because diasporas do tend to earn more money, send it back, promote development. There could be a stabilization there happening as well. That's a much slower and iffy sort of process. But again, it shows that Europe needs to have a more robust strategy for the zones beyond which it can offer concrete membership in the EU. But it's doing it, and it's obviously been far more successful than anyone thought possible, and actually a lot faster. We're very frustrated by Europe's slowness, of course, in the Balkans, Kosovo, and so on. But it's way beyond beyond anyone's previous sort of reckoning.
China, what is its style? What is its way of competing on this new playing field?
So I call Europe's approach consensus-oriented. China's approach is consultative. Within the Asian region, you find that they have developed these institutions without tackling certain very core, you know, geopolitical issues, the extent to which intervention or breaches of sovereignty will be allowed in a political sense. Obviously, the rivalries between Japan and China and the issue of Taiwan. Even by tabling these things, the consultative approach that has been a sort of amalgamation of bilateral relationships rather than the sort of Brussels-driven European approach has actually led to greater trade integration, cross-border investment, greater diplomatic institution building. All of these things have been happening through that Chinese approach. Now, there is a historical precedent to it, and we talked earlier about how China is a non-Western power. The notion of just taking 19th century European great power rivalry and realism doesn't necessarily work on the global scale. There is, as you know, the tribute sort of model of East Asian hierarchy in geopolitics, with China considering itself the heart. The way I see it, that is more or less reappearing, though, of course, again, in an age of nation states with firm borders. But one finds that China is trying to sort of co-opt as much as possible, even America's allies, through those diplomatic structures and through those trade relationships. And it is working on a cultural level. Of course, China has a huge demographic advantage because it's much of its monstrous 50 million diaspora is located in the Pacific Rim and are key economic levers in that region with a lot of political influence. So in any case, this is happening on a variety of levels, this consultative approach to diplomacy. And of course, one small addition, is what you see in China's relations with Africa and with Latin America, which is basically saying, what do you want? What do we want? And let's not go beyond that. Let's just stick to sort of business. And that's also part of the deal. You know, there's no, that's part of their approach. There's no major normative kind of issues such as democracy promotion and so forth. And that is part of the style. So, you know, it may carry the label of anti-hegemonism or whatever, but more or less it's just, you know, it really reflects a Chinese deferential, in a way, almost approach to diplomacy.
Now, the one country that seems to be doing not as good as the others is the United States. And as I listen to you, I'm reminded of the Pentagon guidance document that was issued in the 1990s out of Cheney's shop in the Pentagon when he was Secretary of Defense, looking at a world in which we would be the only superpower, in which we would intervene in any region where somebody seemed to be arising to threaten us. That doesn't seem to be in the cards. That is the success of that model in dealing with these other regions.
Right.
So are we dealing with an America that has too much baggage from a previous Cold War era and unable to adapt?
Too much mental military baggage, for sure. I mean, that strategy, people had not woken up to the non-military means of building influence in the early 1990s. Otherwise, they would not have produced such a document. The fact is that China has grown militarily, for sure. Its investment, its military and defense is enormous. But the means by which they're rising and extending their influence is globalization. How does one attack a country for globalizing?
Mm-hmm.
You can't. And Europe, of course, has risen under our security umbrella. So we have sponsored the rise of one, and through economic globalization of the other, have sponsored their rise as well. So what the international economic community and what American foreign policy have done, on the one hand, is to elevate and accelerate the rise of rivals for leadership, or at least co-leaders in the world, while the Pentagon strategy was obviously quite antiquated. Now, the Pentagon is trying to adjust that, obviously, but it shows how far we have needed to come mentally in the last decade or more.
Now, I'm curious, who did you write this book for? Global policy audiences? With an emphasis on helping the U.S. understand, because I think what I get out of your book, and also from, you know, just being informed, is that we are adapting least well to this new world, the world which, as you just said, we help create.
Well, adaptation is the key thing. Rather than focusing on how do we resurrect the previous Western-led multilateral order and bring others into that, I don't think we're waking up to the fact that there is a new diplomatic order in which people are building, Europe and China and others are building their own sort of, you know, orders and institutions. So we are, in a way, stuck in the past because we aren't leading a new order the way others are. We are, the only order that we know is the one that we built, but that others aren't subscribing to as much as before. Meanwhile, we're also accused of destroying that order through our own sort of unilateralism. So certainly adaptation is the question, and we aren't necessarily adapting all that quickly. And yet, ironically, America is still a global leader and one of the driving forces of globalization. There's still many opportunities for America to restore itself. But again, other than the military realm, where America is the unquestioned superpower or hyperpower, in other areas, you see a much more level playing field.
Mm-hmm. You quote at one point in the book Spengler, his emphasis on the importance of unique cultural systems. And he argued that Western ideals are neither transferable or relevant. And then you also you talk about Niebuhr's concern about messianic consciousness. I take from both of these the extent to which American exceptionalism and its way of thinking about transforming the world just isn't a fit for the world that you're describing.
It really isn't. I mean, strictly speaking, just look at what a small share of the world population and a smaller share of the global economy we represent. The context in which I discuss these historical philosophers and personalities is the notion that there is a new East-West tension in the world. The Cold War was called the East-West rivalry. Of course, that was not the real East. The real East is the East of India, China, and beyond, which is more, represents half the world's population and is developing its own systems, models, priorities, and modes of conducting business. That is the real East. And there is most certainly an element of non-transferability, as you said, in terms of the ability of the West to impose itself on the East. That will no longer happen. There is going to have to be a synthesis, a reconciliation. That doesn't sit well with this sort of messianic, exceptionalist kind of mentality in the United States. But what I find, interestingly, is that every rising power has its own sense of exceptionalism. It is not just an American trait. Every empire in the past, Britain, of course, thought of itself as quite exceptional and to some extent still does. And in a way, I explore that psychology because there is a European exceptionalism that is emerging in terms of those who view it as a common force for good in the world. And there is most definitely a Chinese exceptionalism that has a history and lineage mentally that goes back well over 1,000 years.
But you're suggesting that although each might have a sense of its own exceptionalism, you're suggesting that in terms of the modality by which they implement that as they relate to the world, the Europeans and the Chinese are doing a better job because of this respect for the integrity of a world in which countries want to do it their way.
Well, they're both sort of newcomers to the global stage. So by necessity, their rise and influence, particularly in the Second World, comes at a cost to our influence. So within countries that used to be purely American allies, one finds, again, this sort of playing all sides. But it's true, the ability to sort of penetrate foreign countries, second world countries, and the other powers and convince them of the American way, so to speak, the American model, whether it's the economic or political model, or convince them of American geostrategic priorities, has fallen very, very flat. And there is an appeal in many countries for the sort of Chinese way. You have regimes, and again, regimes and people are obviously two different things at times, but across North Africa and in the Middle East and elsewhere, you have people saying, China does economic growth and then political reform. That makes sense to us. What happens is that often the dictates that come from Washington are just a bridge too far. A country that is poor or second world country can't become America overnight. What is the middle way? And China represents a sort of, gradualist approach to achieving what America may want countries to achieve that is more attainable in a very tangible, concrete, what do I do tomorrow kind of way. You can't become Jeffersonian democracy tomorrow. What means do societies have? First, they have to enrich themselves. And the Chinese model is working for developing countries to copy. You can't copy American capitalism overnight. Similarly, smaller countries are saying, what can we learn from Europe? Well, Europe represents this transnational model where small countries lower borders and cooperate. Again, America doesn't offer that model because we are one big territorial empire. So African Union, ASEAN, and others are saying, let's try and bring down our borders internally and copy and emulate something of Europe. So there is an adaptability issue where there's a demand for solutions that Europe and China sort of meet. And can advise on that America has much more difficulty transferring.
If you were writing a memo to the next president, you have some ideas about how America can change the modalities by which it addresses the world. Talk a little about them because you're looking at a kind of systemic overhaul of the way we do policy.
Right. A systemic overhaul of the world is underway, and that's certainly what the book is about. Mm. But then there's the systemic overhaul of America's worldview. I begin with a very blunt point, which is that the notion that something is in America's interest and therefore should automatically appeal to anyone else in the world outside of the 50 United States has completely disappeared. And I do mean completely. I need to emphasize that for everyone who doesn't get to sort of, you know, travel as much. So everything has to now be phrased in terms of global interests. It is a global good to reduce poverty, to combat terrorism, and so forth. Only if things are phrased in that way and are made convincing and persuasive in that way do we stand any chance of gaining allies for any specific or for general sort of patterns or operations. Very, very, very essential point. It goes beyond this notion of public diplomacy. Public diplomacy is just propaganda the way it's practiced today. I'm talking about a real shift in diplomatic style. So that's, you know, number one. The second thing is what we talked about earlier, which is going directly to Europe and China, recognizing their growing power and saying, what is going to be the division of labor in providing public goods? Where America does it alone, it feels it's overstretched or it becomes unwelcome. So do we pull back? Well, no, because we still have those global interests. So how do we create a real burden sharing among the big three? Again, not being done represents a huge shift in the way we think about the world. Those are a couple of areas.
You also talk about, I think you call them matchmen, that is finding
marchmen.
Marchmen. The notion being to mobilize our volunteerism and our citizens to be out there representing American interests.
Right. The term, of course, comes from the British historian Arnold Toynbee, and I adapt it to the sort of 21st century diplomatic landscape where I say people are power. You know, you have to export people and ideas, and that's part of what he meant when he used the term in the 20th century. But Europe has a larger percentage of its populations that are based overseas, either as diplomats or business people or educators, whatever. And China has a huge volume of people, even if it's small compared to its total population size. Less than 1% of the American citizenry resides outside the United States. Of course, we've educated a huge number of people, foreign leaders, students, businessmen, so on, who then in some way carry American ideas. But Americans themselves also have to do it. And it's not just our diplomatic corps, which is tiny, which is only several thousand Foreign Service officers, which could easily be, you know, much larger than that. But it's, you know, our Peace Corps is a wonderful program, but is very small. It's students. It is business people as well who go and train and set up the markets and systems overseas. A lot more of you know, reaching deeper into American society to push resources out in order to become, to again, to be competitive with Europe and with China.
Now, at a certain point in the book, you call for Pentagonizing our diplomacy.
Right.
What did you mean by that? Right. After listening to you, it's clearly not about emphasizing military power more.
No, it's Pentagonizing the State Department. But diplomacy itself is something so much broader that is across all agencies and across all sort of American actors. I think of diplomacy as something much broader than just the State Department. But the State Department's organization, when I say Pentagonize it, it's a matter of geographic decentralization. It already has it on paper. There's Assistant Secretaries of State for different regions who report to an undersecretary for political affairs and so on. But they do not have the kind of power that the commanders who head CENTCOM, PAYCOM, and the other geographically oriented blocks on the Pentagon's map have. And for that reason, they're not able to coordinate regional affairs and strategies across borders as well as the Pentagon does. And they don't have the resources at their disposal, the diplomatic clout. All of these things are lacking. And I mean those specific instrumental bureaucratic changes when I say Pentagonize the State Department.
And you also suggest that we're not making the global economy work for the country as a whole. At one point in the book, you make the point that globalization in, for example, Asia is creating a middle class and strengthening it, whereas here globalization is seen as a diminishing or of the middle class.
Well, clearly, you know, I mean, voters seem to be seeing globalization as not entirely serving their interests. It depends on whom. America's multinational corporations are experiencing more revenues and growth overseas than they are in domestic markets. Were it not for the rise of those markets, American multinationals would be in tremendous trouble today. General Motors, Coca-Cola, and so forth, their growth overseas is absolutely humongous. So for them, globalization is a very good thing. But what about when globalization leads to outsourcing, the gutting of the industrial base, and all of those sorts of things? Then it's not so good. What Asian countries are doing, China and Malaysia and Singapore and others, is they have sort of a state capitalist model, which is really taken from Europe. And it's this collusion, really, between public and private. It's strategic globalization, basically. It's a coherent strategy. Now, America receives, obviously, a great deal of foreign direct investment, though for the first time either a year or two ago, China became the greatest recipient of foreign direct investment in the world, and the U.S. is number two. To what extent, as China does, in terms of channeling that investment into developing and building the infrastructure, are we using foreign investment to renew our infrastructure? America has had a world-leading infrastructure for much of the 20th century, but that is in constant need of reappraisal, renewal, reconstruction almost, because roads, bridges, the things that every day when you turn on the news, the levees, we have floods going on right now, the things that are breaking and collapsing, and the need to bring in a 21st century infrastructure, broadband, internet penetration, and so forth, all of these things are very weak in America.
You say we need a Marshall Plan for America.
We more or less do, right? And this is why people talk about, Joe Stiglitz and others talk about this. This is the real major guns and butter trade-off right now in a country that is deep in deficit and now experiencing a recession. How are we going to finance the massive infrastructural overhaul and renewal that we need to strengthen the country, literally, physically strengthen it, create modern jobs for everyone, and then close that middle class? That's going to require utilizing the foreign direct investment in this country a lot better than we have.
I see your book as an exercise in political education as it relates to American audience. What do you think will be the thing that transforms our discourse so that we have a better handle on what's happening in the world and how do we relate to it?
It's a very difficult question because America is fundamentally, when all is said and done, at the end of the day, America is still a country that, because of its geographic isolation, is actually able to remain relatively aloof. It always bothers me a bit, even as someone who became an American citizen and has traveled the world, when foreigners say, you Americans don't even have passports. I say, America has everything right here. Americans don't really need passports. Americans don't have to speak five languages. We're not surrounded by countries with whom we've been fighting wars for centuries. I think, you know, America is, in that geographic sense, a blessed sort of place. So it's going to take a lot to achieve broad political education, as you're saying, about the world. It would be nice if it began with our elites. You know, that would be a good start. But we do need it on a broader sort of, you know, democratic basis. And it has to obviously go beyond just reading, you know, and it has a lot to do with our media, of course, which after 9/11 we were promised was going to be covering foreign events a lot more. And it does a bit, but one finds that the number of foreign correspondent postings and the volume of foreign news coverage and television and so forth have not really increased to the extent that they perhaps need to achieve this kind of education. And then, of course, my personal bias, I advocate travel as much as possible and going out and seeing for oneself what's happening in the world. Absolutely essential on an individual level. And given the lack of a national strategy in this area, why would that be any less effective than anything else that we can sketch out on paper but don't have the money for?
Mm-hmm. Well, in writing this book and thinking all the things that you were focusing on, what surprised you the most? That was unexpected after all of these travels and going to these different places with ideas about the world that you had before you went?
You know, one of the ideas is people always describe the world as being either pro or anti-American, as if it's America-centric. Although, you know, I had an inkling, obviously, in writing this book that was not the case. But the best term I could come up for it in the end was the non-American world. And that's something I emphasize throughout the book. The extent to which the world can move on and get by and prosper and conduct its own business without America is something of a wake-up call, even to an American, or even to someone like me who's American but travels a great deal. So that was something that was particularly surprising, the confidence, the energy, the extent to which technology helps to modernize societies in whichever way they choose, even if that technology may have originated in America, it quickly becomes global. So what surprised me is the way in which globalization really divorces the instruments for modernity and achieving one's own goals from America. America is giving gifts, basically, you know, public goods to the world. It's not particularly appreciated. But it's a major factor in driving this massive psychological shift that I felt and that I write about.
Well, Parag, thank you very much for being here. Let me show your book again, The Second World, which I highly recommend as a great read, but one that combines a macro analysis with a micro analysis and really gives us a feel for the different places you go to. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.